This is Jim Inkster, and welcome to Talk Louisiana, signature support from First Financial Tax and Accounting Services. Your number is 877-217-5757. Emails to talk at talklouisiana.org. We start with the remarkable Rick Barry, a basketball legend like few others, the only person to lead the NCAA, the ABA, and the NBA in scoring. He won a world title with the Golden State Warriors in 1975, leading that team to the championship on his back. And in 1967, when Steve McQueen was making bullet in San Francisco and Willie Mays and Willie McCovey and Juan Marichal were ruling baseball at Candlestick Park, Rick Barry, at an arena they called the Cal Palace, was leading the San Francisco Warriors to the NBA Finals, and his team lost in the championship round to Wilt Chamberlain. But in that series, Rick Barry averaged 41 points per game. We can talk about the numbers, but the man is quite impressive himself, and he is still at the top of his game when it comes to analyzing basketball and life at large. And good morning to you, Rick Barry.
Thank you. It's so funny that you mentioned Steve McQueen, because I actually got to meet Steve McQueen. He was quite the character. He used to have a German half track that he would take out into the desert in Palm Springs. He was pretty amazing. I always remember him, you know, in the war movie and everything, when he was trying to do the Great Escape. I always remember him going into the cooler and throwing the baseball against the wall. So it's sort of funny that you brought his name up.
Well, that was one of the classic scenes in film history, the chase scene, which lasts over 10 minutes in Bullet. And Steve McQueen was, I think we could call him a man's man. But Rick, when he stood beside you, he was probably about a foot shorter than you.
Yeah, he wasn't very tall. A lot of the actors aren't very tall. People don't realize that, you know, when you get a chance to meet some of these people in person and see them. And, you know, you see Arnold Schwarzenegger, you know, the big strong guy. He was a pretty short guy. So yeah. It's always been interesting. But I've had the good fortune of meeting I sometimes think about the people who I've met in my life, and just remarkable, some very incredibly famous people. And it was a real honor for me to meet those people, because I love greatness. I love greatness in anyone. Anybody that's great at what they do, I have incredible respect and admiration for them, because I know the effort that had to be put forth in order to achieve that greatness.
You had a quest for excellence that is apparent, and it remains in effect as a senior citizen now. Rick is one of the best pickleball players in the world, but he was always into physical fitness, and I think that probably enabled you to play into your late 30s at a time when few players were doing that.
Well, yeah, I could have actually played longer, except the NBA, to show you how things have changed. I mean, the Golden State Warriors, I give you an idea. The NBA back in 1980 cut their rosters from 12 to 11 to save money. Now they have 15 and two-way guys. The value of the franchise is, I had someone who was one, a friend of mine, wanted to buy the Warriors back in the day for $18 million. The Warriors now are worth over $4 billion. So times do change, that's for sure.
And the compensation for players has changed today.
Well, don't even get into that, please. I don't want to start crying on this interview, because I never heard the word million in my contract negotiations. I just figured out they forgot three zeros on all of my contracts.
Well, people of a certain age remember you as a broadcaster, but they may not remember the late 1960s when you were in your prime, and you defected to the ABA from the NBA right after the 67 championship series, and you basically gave up 2 years of your career right in your prime. That had to be difficult.
It was only one year I gave up, and I look back and I go, what the hell was I thinking? I mean, at the time, I just got off of an amazing season and two great seasons, and then played for the KYA Radio Wonders to raise money for high schools for a year. That was crazy. Crazy. If I had to do it over again, I'd never do it.
Rick Barry is our guest, and Rick, you're fading on us a little bit, but I think we can get you back to a better place, and the number is 877-217-5757 if you'd like to engage this remarkable man. And Rick Barry has five sons who played professional basketball as well, and it goes without saying you had a big impact on their lives.
Well, my big thing is I try to warn them about playing basketball. and hopefully we have a good signal because I'm actually on Wi-Fi.
You're good. You're good now. You're good.
All right. So, and I just told them, I said, boys, if you decide you want to play basketball, just remember that you're going to have a giant shadow cast over you. Everybody's going to compare you to me, and it's not going to be an easy thing for you to do. And I always remember my son John when he was young. He says, it doesn't matter that. I'm going to be better than you were anyway. And I said, son, I hope you're right. But yeah, it's not easy to follow in the footsteps of a successful parent. And my boys all handled it, I think, quite well. I said, look, just be yourself. Don't try to be me. Be yourself and be the best that you can be. And everything will work out just fine. And it did for them. You know, just a couple of those guys, they made more money in one season than I made in 14.
I know. And as good as they were not as good as Dad, who was one of the great players of all time. Do you feel you've gotten your just due? When you look at the numbers, and we talked a bit the other day, and we were talking primarily about Wilt Chamberlain, who was a contemporary of Rick Barry, born 8 years earlier, but their lives intersected, and I don't think there's any doubt Chamberlain was the greatest player ever. But Rick Barry, you have the same kind of numbers at the forward position, small forward, that they just haven't been replicated by many, if any, players, and yet I don't know that you've gotten your credit for the accomplishments that you, the immense accomplishments you had as a NBA and ABA player.
Well, first of all, Wilt, I think, is the greatest center. I mean, people do this all the time, and I just totally disagree with it. You can't pick the best player in a team sport. It has to be by position. You can't compare Wilt Chamberlain to Magic Johnson to Michael Jordan to LeBron James. I mean, you just can't do that because it takes different skills to play every position. That'd be like baseball comparing my boyhood hero Willie Mays to Sandy Koufax, one of the greatest lefty pitchers ever. You can't compare them because the skills are different. And so it's the same in basketball. So to me, Wilt was the greatest center, and anybody else that somebody brings up that, you know, is running second, I mean, that's a simple fact. I go to my grave with that. And I can't even believe to see some people in modern days actually listed top three centers of all time and didn't have Chamberlain listed. These people need to go and do a real study about what basketball is all about and see what Wilt Chamberlain did. They say records are made to be broken. Wilt did things that will never, ever be broken, and they're beyond almost comprehension. Averaging 50 points a game for an entire NBA season is just mind-numbing to me. I mean, I average 37. I'm saying, wait, I'd have to average 13 more points a game for 80-something games to be able to have 50 a game. There are guys who have played many years, and there are many, many players who played in the NBA who can't even average 13 points a game.
And are making millions and millions for doing that. But I think the short answer is that you were extremely underrated. And to give you an idea, I've heard the same thing said about Pete Maravich, and it may have been more accurate about Pete than Rick, is that Pete didn't play much defense, but I've heard that about you. And yet I know you led the league in steals. I know you averaged more than, I think, 7 rebounds a game as a small forward, which is not common. You were a complete player, weren't you?
Yes, I try to be. Yeah, my father was a semi-pro player and coach, and you know, his big thing was you can't have any glaring weaknesses, because if you do, it'll be exploited. And you have to be able to go right and left and handle the ball. And I'm just talking about offense, and you have to be able to shoot the ball, because then a player has to guard you. He has to guard you normally. He can't take the right away or take the left away, because you can go either way. And he has to guard you because you can shoot the ball, so he has to come up on you. If he comes up on you, then it makes it easier to be able to have an opportunity to beat him off the dribble. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, I took great pride in the fact that I was well-rounded. And for anybody to say that I wasn't a great defensive player, I mean, that's ludicrous. I was not a bad defensive player, but it'd be pretty ridiculous for me to think that I could go, and I hear the thing, he's a lockdown defender. Trust me. If a player is a great offensive player, okay, is a scorer, you can't lock a scorer down. That's impossible. It is impossible. There's no such thing as a lockdown defender. When I hear some of these analysts on television, all these former players say, well, he's a lockdown defender, I'm going, well, maybe you got locked down in your career. Nobody ever locked me down. I mean, and they can't. It's just impossible to lock somebody down.
Uh-huh. A couple of questions from listeners. One, how would your average have been? Rick, by the way, for his career, averaged 25 a game, more than 25, I believe, a little bit more. And if you'd had the three-point play, and when did you start shooting the free throws underhanded?
Well, if they had the three-point shot the entire time, I would have averaged way more points. There's no question about that, because it came later in my career with the ABA, and I got to be like a 33% three-point shooter, which to me, this is fine. 30% is, you know, if you can't reach 30, you have no business shooting it. 33 is okay. I mean, the reason it's okay, because at 33 equates actually to 50% from twos, which is outstanding. So, but if I were playing today, I would not be satisfied if I weren't a 40% or better three-point shooter, and I would have worked at it to get my get me to be that good of a shooter. So, yeah, I would have averaged a lot more points. I also, my average is skewed and all, because I was willing to go to a team, the Rockets, and take a subservient role where I wasn't an integral part of the offense, and I only averaged 12 and 13 points a game, which basically knocked down my overall career scoring average considerably, because you took 160 games. You take 160 games out of my Rocket stuff and add it up, and it's probably a much more significant average.
All right, well, hold that thought. We do have to take a 90-second pause, and we will return with Rick Barry, one of the great free throw shooters of all time, and he did it in an unconventional way at the time. Back after this. This is Jim Inkster. Pleased you're listening to Talk Louisiana. Robert Dow is producing, and we're spending some time with Rick Barry, one of the great players in college and professional basketball. He grew up in New Jersey, where baseball was his best sport as a youth, and his idol was Willie Mays, who wore number 24. That's the number Rick wore, in tribute to the outfielder who played not far from him in San Francisco in 1965. When I was a little kid, I remember Willie Mays hit 52 home runs, and shortly thereafter, Rick Barry came to the Bay Area and took it by storm as a basketball player, and led the Warriors to a championship in 1975. 877-217-5757 if you'd like to pose a question for Rick Barry. What about the underhanded free throws? When did you start doing that, Rick?
Well, my dad, as I mentioned, was a semi-pro player and coach, and that's the way he shot. In those days, players shot two hands underhand at the free throw line, two hand set shots. And the jump shot and all hadn't really, you know, come along. And my father felt that I could be a better free throw shooter. I was maybe mid-70s, and I didn't want to do it because back in those days, the girl shot that way, and I said, I can't do that. Everybody's going to make fun of me. And I always remember him saying, it was like yesterday. I could hear it so vividly, son, they can't make fun of you if you're making them. And so, to be honest with you, I was glad he was so relentless about it, because I didn't want to do it, and he kept bugging me and bugging me. I finally said, okay, let's go work on this. So I worked on it in the summer. And I don't remember if it was before my junior year in high school or my senior year. So, but I worked on it, and I gave it a really sincere effort. Okay, so to my credit, and thank God I did, and I said, well, this is actually pretty darn good. And so I decided to make the switch. And so I remember being in the first game on the road that season in high school when we were playing in Scotch Plains, New Jersey. And I'm shooting later in the game, and I hear a guy from the stands yell out, hey, Barry, you big sissy shooting like that. And I heard the guy next to him so clearly say, what are you making fun of him for? He doesn't miss. And I was cool from that point forward. Never had a problem.
Les in New Orleans asked, could you have helped somebody like Shaquille, who had free throw problems? Wilt also had problems. But or is that something that is inherent? Can you teach somebody to shoot free throws?
Oh, of course. You can teach somebody to shoot. Period. I mean, but the problem with Shaq was Shaq had a broken wrist when he was younger. Shaq could never be a great shooter overhand, but he couldn't possibly have the absolute correct form because he couldn't bend his wrist properly. And I tried to get him to do it, but he told me, he said, Rick, I'm a hip-hop kind of guy, and it'd be bad for my image, and he's too big for me to have to argue with. And so it's unfortunate, because if Shaq had learned how to shoot the underhand free throw, one of my teammates, George Johnson, did it. He actually wound up becoming an 80% free throw shooter. Shaquille O'Neal, during his career, if he was an 80% free throw shooter, would have won more championships. There never would have been the hack of Shaq to come along, because he would have been in at the end of the game, and you just had to throw the ball into him in the post, and the game would have been over.
Yep. And Dale Brown, our dear friend, has noted that in his final game at LSU, Shaq was 14 of 14 from the line. But that was rare, and a lot of big guys do tend to have more trouble shooting free throws for whatever reason. But you did it like few others, and you did it underhanded, and now you just don't see many players do it. But I'm surprised there aren't more.
Well, I don't know why, because it's proven by physicists have done testing. Everybody's done all kinds of testing. And it's proven to be the most efficient way to do it. My youngest son, Canyon, does it. He, you know, one time in that shortened season in the G League when he was playing, when they had COVID and everything, actually didn't miss a free throw for the short season. He shot up in the 90 percentile. He's 85 to 90% mm-hmm. guy regularly. And he had to make a bit of an adjustment because I used to let the ball hang down, right, you know, kind of between my legs, but I had short shorts. With the long shorts on, the shorts get in the way. So he actually had to hold it away from his body a little bit because he couldn't do it exactly my way. But it's one of the things that I see in life, you should never be satisfied. I'm never satisfied with what I do. I always try to get better. And that's just the way I approach things. And when it came to free throws, that is exactly what happened. I figured out, can I do this better? And I was already the best free throw shooter in the league. And I decided, yeah, wait a second, I can try to do this. So I took my wrist, the wrist out of the shot. So I didn't have a wrist that was cocked and uncocked. And I rolled my hands together. And my last 6 years, I shot over 92%, which is better than anybody's ever done. And then my last 2 years, I shot over 94%. So I was actually a better free throw shooter at the end of my career. And I just wish I had been intelligent enough to figure that out earlier in my career, because when I was first playing, I was shooting over 10 free throws a game. And if I had that technique, because it's a lot easier to shoot a high percentage when you're shooting a lot of free throws. If I'm shooting 12 free throws in a game and I miss one, I could still be up over 90% very easily in that game. But late in my career, when I averaged a 94.5, you know, over 94% mm-hmm. percentile, if I missed one, and I was only shooting a couple free throws a game, if I missed one free throw, I had to go weeks in games and not missing a free throw in order to get that percentage up.
You're right. Jonathan in New Iberia, please be brief. Jonathan, you're on with Rick Barry. Good morning, sir.
We'll be brief. Jack Sigma, excellent free throw shooter. He was in high 80s, low 90s for Seattle.
All right, and he was a big guy, and I'll look him up. I don't think he was quite that high, but he was a pretty good free throw shooter, and it's not universal. But does hand size have anything to do with it, Rick? You had big hands, but some of these guys are just enormous.
It does if they don't do it properly. They have to make it. You have to have a passive thumb when you shoot the basketball. And actually, a big hand, you should be actually better, because the big hand allows you to feel the ball in your hands rolling up, coming off your fingertips, and you should develop even greater feel because you have control of the ball for a longer period of time as it's rolling up and off of your fingertips. And the biggest thing is most big guys, they use their thumb and then they grab the ball with their hands and they don't really get it laying on the pads of their hands and letting it roll up properly off their hands. So having a big hand is not an excuse for being a bad shooter. It's because their form was bad and somebody mm-hmm. didn't teach him how to do it properly.
And Jack Sigma, his career was 84.9. So that's
yeah, great. 80%. Here's the thing. If you're not an 80% free throw shooter, you're not a good free throw shooter. End of story.
Really? you know, Pete Maravich was in the low 80s, and he was a guy, as you know, a run-and-gun guy who scored a lot of points in college and in the pros, and he also is one of the 50 greatest players named all time. But some people believe that he was a hot dog. What are your thoughts about Pete?
I got to know Pete. In fact, Pete was really helpful to my youngest son, Scooter. I always was grateful to him for that. And they got close, and then he passed away. It was, you know, my son was kind of crushed when that happened, my son Scooter. But Pete and I went on a tour together over to Asia and played together after we retired and had so much fun, really got to know him well. And, you know, he went through some difficult times, obviously, and worrying about people from outer space and all kinds of other crazy things. But the guy could really play, and he was an amazing scorer and just a really good guy. In fact, on that game, I played point guard in game against the Taiwanese national team. I told Phil Jackson, who was our player coach, I said, Phil, let me play point. I said, they're playing a 2-1-2. I said, Pete, I'm going to come down and I'm going to split the 2-1-2 at the top, just spot up in the seam. I had 18 assists in the game, 15 of them were Pete.
Well, he could play, and of course in basketball, to play at the levels you did, there aren't as many white players as there are black players. Is that something that was brought to your attention through the years? I remember once in a Sports Illustrated article, I don't remember who was quoted, but it was a famous black player who said the white boy could play some basketball, referring to you. Were you considered an aberration of any kind?
Yeah, Clifford Ray tells me all the time, he says, the brothers love you, man. You know, and then they had to think, somebody wrote a story one time, I remember, that he's a white player who plays black, a black player who plays white. I mean, which is ridiculous. Like, you're a player, you play according to the skills that you have to play the game a certain way. It has nothing to do with the color of your skin. It just has to do with your athleticism. So that is kind of foolish. But I do have a lot of respect from the people in the black community. Because here's the thing, I was fast and quick and tall, and they didn't see that very often. I was the first player my size who would bring the ball up the floor and do the things that I did. If I were playing today, I'd have to be a better ball handler. I was a good ball handler, but all I did was righty lefty crossover, none of the fancy stuff they do now. But to get to be better at ball handling, all you have to do is go in the gym and do all of the drills, and the one ball drills and the two ball drills, and you can get this, you can get yourself to be better. That's a skill that can be taught. It's not something that's God-given. You can learn how to do those things. And some of the things the players do right now are absolutely incredible, but a lot of it is not needed. You want to keep it as simple as possible.
Hold tight. We'll spend a bit more time with the remarkable Rick Barry as we return on Talk Louisiana after this. This is Jim Inkster. Thank you for being with us for Talk Louisiana. A few more minutes with Rick Barry, who remains one of the foremost authorities when it comes to sports at large. He likes all the sports. He's played most of them, and he's still active. And while we have time, I know you're a champion pickleball player. You really like that game, don't you?
Yeah, it's amazing. It's the fastest growing sport in the United States, maybe in the world. There's over 60 countries playing it now. They're trying to get it into the Olympics. But it's a great sport to play. I used to play tennis, but then that got to be much too hard on my body. I was a pretty good tennis player. And pickleball, I just worked at it. It's, like I say, exploding. And I'm involved in a number of companies involved in the pickleball world and doing some things with Selkirk paddles and just having a great time with it, and a lot of competitiveness, and have won a number of national titles and world senior championships. And I don't play singles. It's too hard on my body. I have no cartilage in my knee, so I play doubles. So I have to search and try to find good partners to be able to win in men's doubles and mixed doubles. And so I've had the good fortune of doing that. My wife's a great player, but she doesn't want to play competitively, and you know, she's younger, and so I'd have to play down in the 60s. But I played in tournaments in the 50s and actually won tournaments playing against people that, you know, 20 years or more younger than I am. But in pickleball, it's not necessarily your age. It's the big thing. It's your skill level.
And you've kept in tip-top shape as much as you can. You've had basketball injuries, but at 6'7", what was your playing weight, and what do you weigh now?
Well, I finished my career playing at about 215 pounds or so, 215, 218, and I was 6'7" and a half in my bare feet. Unfortunately, when you get older, you shrink, and I had a bad bicycle accident, fractured my pelvis, was in a wheelchair for 3 months, and I'm only 6'5" right now, so it's the only good thing about it is I can get pants a lot easier, so I can perfect 38, 36 now, so it's great.
But you're probably what? You're still around 210, I would say? Maybe even
more. I stay still around the 212 to 215 mark, and my waist is, you know, maybe an inch to an inch and a half or so bigger than it was when I was in college.
Well, in college, you played for a man who became your father-in-law, Bruce Hale, and you led the nation in scoring at Miami. You put that program on the map, college basketball. Those were heady times, and of course, I think you were second player in the draft, I believe, when you came out. How did you end up going from New Jersey to Miami?
Well, if you live in New Jersey, you know that you want to have a chance to go to Miami, you go. You know? I said I didn't want to go to school somewhere where I have to wear an overcoat and scarf and gloves and galoshes, and so I wanted to go someplace where it was warmer, and the style of play that Miami had, Bruce Hale was a former top NBA player, and they played bro-style basketball. So for me, it was like 4 years in being in the minor leagues preparing for the NBA, and very few players come out of college and are able to do what I did. And the reason I was able to do it was not just because, you know, God-given talent and skill and the help of coaches. It's because of the fact that I had 4 years of training to go into the league. And when I was in college, the entire defense was set up to try to shut me down. Okay. But in pros, I had one guy guarding me. I said, oh my God, this is unbelievable. This is easy. And so the transition was very, very easy for me to go and play that way. And then, just so people have an understanding, in 1965, my senior year, no 3-point shot, our team averaged 98 points a game. We pushed the ball and we played. We were like Lakers Showtime. Get up and down the floor. I had three other guys from Indiana. When they crossed half court, they thought they were in range. If we had a three-point shot, we'd average 110 points a game.
Well, a listener notes that you also average 5 assists a game as a pro, and that is correct, in addition to 7 rebounds and 25 points. So those are numbers that hold up extremely well over the course of time. And I do want to note that Rick, and perhaps a bit of an irony, one of his closest friends is Dale Brown, and he also was a friend of Jimmy Taylor. And Jimmy Taylor, before he died a few years ago, lived just a few blocks away from Coach Brown. But how did you and Coach Brown hook up?
I got to really know him during the Goodwill games. So Ted Turner did the Goodwill games over in Moscow when I was working for Turner Broadcasting, and he happened to be over there. And we got to spend a lot of time together and got to know him. And just I love Dale. He's a great guy. I would have loved to have played for him and have him be my coach. And I have a lot of respect for him. And we're very much alike because we stand up for things. Both of us were someone that wasn't going to just sit by and let people do things that we didn't think was right. You know, he's famous for all of his fights with the NCAA and my thing about challenging the reserve clause before Curt Flood did it in baseball. And so we're kind of renegades in that regard, but he's a terrific guy. I'm proud to call him a friend, and I'm glad that he's doing well. And when you mentioned about the Goodwill games over there, I mean, that was an interesting experience, you know, seeing Russia back in those days and the way that it was. It was kind of crazy. Kind of crazy for sure.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, lastly, you mentioned the reserve clause. You did lose a year, and that was right after the 67 championship series. So you would have been 23 years old, 23 to 24. And then I think only played 35 games the following year. I might be wrong. But anyway, that had to take some brass to sit out at that point.
Yeah, as I say, if I had to do it over again, I wouldn't do it. But I just, you know, basketball had always been fun for me. I mean, we came within 2 pick and roll plays of winning the NBA championship. I led the league in scoring. I was the MVP of the All-Star game, and I really didn't have a great amount of fun. God rest his soul, I knew him, a terrific person, but Bill Sharman was not easy to play for. He took the fun out of the game. We hardly ever had time off. And so I had a chance to go and get reunited, I thought, with my father-in-law, who was my coach in college. And so, but I gave the Warriors every chance to get me, and they just totally blew it. And that's a whole other story. We don't have time to get into it. I will point one other thing out. You brought up my assist. I can tell you right now, I got more satisfaction out of making a pass to get an assist for my teammates and get an assist and get them a basket than I did making it myself. In fact, one of the things I'm proudest of record-wise, I don't pay attention to stats. I think I still hold the record for the most assists by a forward. I had 19 assists on the road in Chicago, and I like to joke about it, saying, well, if I had 19 and we were in Chicago, more than likely I had 20 or more, because I know they screwed me out of a couple.
And another listener, we'll let you go after this, but notes, and I mentioned that the 67 championship series against the 76ers, and you lost to Wilt in a memorable series. You averaged 41 points a game, but if I remember right, you were hurt in that series, weren't you?
Yeah, I would love to have been healthy. I had a really, really bad sprained ankle. In fact, they wouldn't even probably let me play today. I'm just lucky I didn't ruin my career, because I got my ankle shot up and couldn't feel it before the game and at halftime in order to play in that series. I couldn't practice. And in one of the games, I missed a number of free throws. Yeah, I was not anywhere close to 100% in that series.
Well, Rick Barry, it's a pleasure and an honor. Take care, and let's keep it going. Thank you, my friend.
Happy to have spent the time. Take care. God bless you and your listeners.
That's a deal. And we're joined now by one Mark Ballard, Capital Bureau Chief for The Advocate. And in these days, it's the nation's capital, and much is going on there. But if you're following the news, a substantial story today about what happened yesterday. And Richard Nelson was on this program after tweeting that he was running for governor. He's 36 years old. And Mark Ballard, who knows, with the field as it is, somebody might catch fire. That would seem to be unlikely, but anything is possible. And this guy has good candidate skills. You met him. What do you think?
Well, you're right. He does have good candidate skills. He is putting together policies that would be popular. But I got to believe that the Wonder Boy idea strategy was kind of blown a little bit by Bobby Jindal. And we're talking about a 36-year-old without a whole lot of experience in legislation and state government. despite the fact that he does have a lot of good ideas, and he's a very good campaigner and very personable person.
877-217-5757 for Mark Bauer. Always a great Thursday tradition to visit with him. And Richard Nelson is young enough at 36 and born on the 20th day of May that he was born on Cher's 40th birthday. That puts it in perspective, doesn't it?
Yeah, I guess. His 40th birthday, okay. Well, I wonder if that's something he can run on, you know.
Well, she might sing at his inaugural, you know. By the way, Go ahead. No, we're
kind of... I was going to point out that he's running, saying not that the at 36 that he's running for 40 years down the road, you know, to have an impact for the next 40 years. So,
well, Cher's still going strong. So, anyone and Gary Risponi reminds me that he also was born on February 20th, the brother of Eddie Risponi. Who, you know, Eddie spent about $20 million of his own money 4 years ago and came within 40,000 votes. But you know what? When you do that, you don't have fundraisers to retire your debt. But right now, it is amazing how many people are not pulling the trigger, and people are waiting on Garrett Graves to see what he will do. And the chair of the Republican Party, Lewis Gingrich, has all but warned him not to get in the race. What do you make of this?
I think that Mr. Gingrich does he seems to annoy a lot of the bigger mainstream Republicans with the kind of the far right wing perspective on it, and he may end up as we saw in some of the commentary that he may end up pushing mainstream Republicans into the race just because they're angry at it. So. But I would have suspected that Garrett Graves would have made his announcement if he was going to. But then it's I just don't know. It's hard to he's very unpredictable in many things.
Well, Washington Mardi Gras is coming very soon, isn't it?
It is next week. And,
all right.
And I think that they're going to get started on it like about Tuesday or so.
Well, I would think, because that's where all the politicos gather, and it has become largely a Republican gathering, as you can imagine, that if Garrett Graves is going to run, I would think that he would do it before Washington Mardi Gras festivities begin in earnest. But who knows? But what he can't wait long. The race is getting pretty close. We're inside 9 months now.
Exactly. He can't wait that long, but it would seem like the Washington Mardi Gras would be a good time. All of the gubernatorial candidates are going to be up here, and they're going to be spending their time. The thing about Washington Mardi Gras that you need to remember is it's more like Government Day, and I'll get to it later.
Okay. We will take a break. Mark knows the drill. We'll be back after this. This is Jim Inkster. Thank you for being with us for Talk Louisiana. Robin Dow's producing, and your number is 877-217-5757. Mark Ballard of The Advocate is with us. Let's go to David in Atlanta. David, you're on with Mark.
Good morning, gentlemen. Mr. Ballard, if the Republicans, and I think this time they're quite serious regarding defaulting on the debt, if their demands are not met for raising the debt ceiling, interest rates will rise on mortgages, interest rate on credit cards will rise. 6 million people could lose jobs, et cetera, et cetera. Who would get the main blame by the American people? Do they actually understand the seriousness of this problem? And will the Republicans try to switch and blame this on President Biden?
What do you think, Mark? Thank you, David. Mark?
The Republicans already are trying to blame this on President Biden. Basically, the Treasury is going to be releasing some pretty technical changes today. That is to postpone the raising the debt limit until June or so. And if it doesn't, if they don't raise the debt limit and the America defaults, I would say that it's not just a problem in America, but it'll be a problem around the world, because when other countries have economic problems, they go in for buying U.S. treasuries, and that's how they stabilize their money. I don't think it's going to get to that point. I think there's going to be a lot of talk and political brinkmanship, but in the end, they really can't do that. They're going to have to do something about raising the thing. The Republicans are trying to get the Democrats to cut some of the spending that was approved last year.
Well, a story today in the New York Times says several of the most extreme Republicans in Congress and those closely allied with President Trump have landed seats on the Oversight and Accountability Committee. That's the main investigative organ in the House. And from that perch, they are poised to shape inquiries into the Biden administration. And the members include Marjorie Taylor Greene of Georgia, Paul Gosar of Arizona, Lauren Boebert of Colorado, Scott Perry of Pennsylvania. They're all among the most devoted allies of former President Trump. And the Times puts it this way, their appointments underscore that while the former president may be a shrunken presence in the current political landscape, he still exerts much control over the base of his party. And we don't hear anybody in the Republican delegation from Louisiana saying anything about it, Mark.
And they will avoid saying stuff about it. Basically, traditionally, that the Oversight Committee is peopled by representatives who are not that interested in policy, but mostly about making political points. It's often called the island of misfit toys. And I think that basically they see no real reason not to allow this group to be doing all sorts of investigations, which will take the focus off the fact that the Republicans will in the House will be unable to pass much of their legislation because they don't work with Democrats in the House. They don't work with Democrats in the Senate, and the Senate is Democratic majority, and then the president is a Democrat as well. So this will kind of be the focus will be on Hunter Biden's laptop rather than we're not passing any legislation.
Well, Hunter Biden is one of those irresistible targets for Republicans, and maybe George Santos is one of those irresistible targets for Democrats. And talk about the guy who just keeps on giving news that is unbelievable as far as the length and breadth of his lies. And the latest is that he said his mama died in 9/11. She wasn't even living in the country. And now there is a report that says that he raised $3,000 for a veteran's dog who was dying and then took the money and ran. This guy Santos, where's Garrett Graves? Where's Steve Scalise? Where's Mike Johnson? Clay Higgins? Julia Letlow? John Kennedy? Bill Cassidy? Where are they? Where are they, Mark Ballard?
Well, they're not going to be wading into this. And they would argue to you that, hey, that's not my business. That's leadership's business. So that would, I guess, be Mr. Scalise. But he's also following what the Speaker McCarthy is. And that's basically that they're going to talk bad about Mr. Santos, but they're not going to force his removal from office because, they're going to say because he was duly elected. But, a cynic might say it's because there's such a narrow GOP majority in the House.
Mm-hmm. Well, it is fascinating. And a few days ago on this show, we had Scott Wilfong, the ranking Republican political consultant in Louisiana, who lost a close race to Louis Gingrich for chair of the party a few years ago. Now, Scott said it was perfectly appropriate for Republicans in the House to be investigating Joe Biden over taking documents home with him that were classified and not investigate President Trump, who, of course, did the same thing and then had to get the FBI to come and get him. But he said one's the current president, one's not. Well, I do remember the Republicans in the House grilling Hillary Clinton 3 years after she was Secretary of State, about Benghazi. What do you think, Mark?
It sounds like politics to me. I mean, don't tell me about. There just seem to be irony impaired, and they don't want to hear about how it impacts them. They're just saying, you have sinned.
Mm-hmm.
So.
Well, we're one day away from the 20th day of 2023. So 2 years from tomorrow, there will be a president inaugurated. It could be Joe Biden taking the oath again, or it could be somebody else. It could be another Democrat, or it could be a Republican. But 2 years in politics can be an eternity. But that said, it's kind of like the governor's race. For people who really have a desire to run, they got to ramp up pretty quickly. And right now, I don't know of anybody on the Democratic side. We know Ron DeSantis is going to be running and Donald Trump's going to be running, but on the Republican side. But what about the Democrats? Does anybody really have any intent to run against Joe Biden?
Well, not that I can see. I mean, to be frankly, there is talk that if Biden doesn't run, that then you'll start seeing, you know, people like the California Governor Newsom, perhaps the vice president would get involved. Perhaps Senator Klobuchar from Minnesota would get involved. But right now, if you have an incumbent president running and that's he's giving every indication that that's what he's going to be doing, then my guess is that we're not going to be seeing too many challenges from the Democratic side.
But this document scandal, and that's what it is, it may in degree be something different than what Donald Trump did, but nonetheless, Joe Biden took records home with him that were classified, and that was a long time ago, too. It's been how many years since he was vice president of the United States? He left office in 2017, so we're talking 6 years ago. I don't know that he can offer a plausible explanation that will sit well with the American people, Mark.
No, I think that this all kind of bears the probably too many documents are get a secret designation on it and keeps it out of the public view. And then also the fact that that regardless of party or policy particulars that public officials kind of consider themselves above what regular everyday people do, and they take advantage of it by taking documents home and who knows what else.
Scott in Central says or asks of you, Mark, of the announced candidates for governor, who in your opinion is the least right-wing and perhaps moderate of the more moderate than the others? We're talking about Nelson, we're talking about Schroeder, and of course Jeff Landry. And
Sharon Hewitt,
who was on our show last week.
I would say Richard Nelson, probably.
I don't think there's any doubt. He's a guy for legalization of marijuana and also for exceptions for rape and incest. So he's trying to carve out that side of the spectrum. And right now, there are no Democrats officially in the field. This time a week from now, will we have a Democrat or two in the race, or will they still be on pause?
I would think that we would. I mean, but I don't know who it is. I mean, I've heard, you know, of course, the DOTD Secretary Sean Wilson is a possibility. I've heard that the head of the Democratic Party, Katie Bernhardt, is looking at it, you know, but and there's, you know, so a couple of senators that are looking at it. But so far, we have, you know, nobody's stepped up and said it's going to be me. And most of the political handicappers in Washington think that, you know, it would be a tough row to hoe for a Democrat in Louisiana next year. And that seems to be reasonable analysis to me.
Mm-hmm. And John Bel Edwards, he had 2.5 years before Election Day in which he was a candidate. So that does help. It helps raising money. It helps name recognition, all kinds of things. And these people who are getting in now, they're going to have a sprint rather than a marathon. Phil in Jefferson Terrace, we're short, real short on time, but please be brief. You're on. Hi, Phil.
Good morning. Yeah, good morning. Hi, Jim. Hi, Mark.
All right, what's your question?
Well, what's it like getting around Washington? I mean, you have a good public transportation system. I mean, does it feel like a good city to be in?
All right. You have some inherent advantages there we don't have here, but traffic being one of them.
Yes. I thought of myself as a complainer of traffic in Baton Rouge and found myself to be just a whiny baby because the traffic in D.C. is horrific. But you also have public transportation.
There you go. You have options. Mark Ballard, thanks. We'll call next week. Always a pleasure. And we'll, of course, have news, I'm sure, to convey to the people from Mark. Signature support from First Financial.